Hello and welcome to SD Europe's podcast. My name is Luke Cox. I lead SD Europe's communications.
Many people listening will know Football Supporters Europe. FSE represents football fans in Europe in 48 different countries. SD Europe and FSE have been working together and alongside each other for over a decade now. FSE acting upon issues such as ticketing, fan culture, discrimination and policing in football, and SD Europe aiming to increase supporter involvement in the running of football clubs and football institutions. Today, Ronan Evian, FSD's Executive Director, will talk to us about the challenges the organisation has faced over the past 8 months and what FSE believes needs to happen post-COVID. Ronan, thank you ever so much for accepting our invitation.
Thanks, Luke. It's a pleasure to be with you today after listening to the previous podcast. So thanks for having us.
Great. So to kick things off, could you give a brief introduction of yourself and about your organisation, FSE?
Sure. About myself, I'm based in Brittany in France. I come from ultra background at my club, FC Nantes. I've also been involved in community trust initiatives at club level and national level. I'm involved in France in the INS, the Association Nationale des Supporters, which is the national representative body. And I work for Football Supporters Europe since 2015. I first been the coordinator of the project Respect Fan Culture around the Euro 2016 in France, which was coordinating the deployment of fans' embassies, and I'm the executive director of Football Supporters Europe since late 2016. So as you said, we work on a broad range of issues: ticketing, away fans' rights, discrimination, policing in football, and we work together with SD Europe and also CAFE, so that the three of us, we represent the broad range of fan culture that we have in Europe. We're based in Hamburg in Germany, so obviously having staff in different countries, and at the time of the pandemic, we are all on working from home at the moment, so we're scattered throughout three different countries. And that's who we are.
Great, fantastic introduction. So many listening will have heard about your Out project. Could you tell us briefly about the project and the upcoming closing event?
Yeah, the reason why we started this project against fights against homophobia and any form of discriminations based on sexual orientation and gender identity, the reason why we started this project was that on one hand, we had a growing number of LGBT fan groups in our membership, but also individual members. LGBT fan groups either active at the club level or at the national level, some now like the Three Lions Pride, or even following the national team, the English national team. So we thought we needed to offer them a platform to exchange ideas, views, experiences, good practices, and to influence the work of our work of our organization, so that we can become more inclusive and more familiar with LGBT rights and all the issues surrounding it. And then also, we've been involved in project in the past that were very much in a niche, meaning that it was fans discussing the issues with each other. And we thought that to seek systemic change and to look for, to have a real influence in the world of football, we needed to work with other stakeholders and to build bridges between the various progressive stakeholders in the game in European football. So that's why we have three types of partners in the project. An LGBT fan group, which is Pride in Football, the national coordination of LGBT fan groups in England and Wales. We have an ally organization, Football Fans Against Homophobia in Germany. I won't say that in German, I won't try that. And the Royal Belgium Football Association, which is one of the European football association that's been at the forefront of LGBT inclusion during the last few years. And then working with FIFPro, working with UEFA, working with a number of clubs, leagues, clubs foundations, and looking how all this people can work together and then try to influence how the football in general integrates and offer safe space for LGBT people from the boardroom to the stands, on the pitch, anyone working in football, really. So the project is coming to an end. We are launching it on the 11th of December at an online event at the European Parliament, together with the LGBT Into Group and the Sports Group of the European Parliament. And we're publishing a handbook, which is a collection of good practices and recommendations that can be replicated elsewhere in European football.
Yeah, I think, you know, many listening will agree that in a year when the question and the issue of equality and diversity has been so prominent, I think this is such an important project. And as I say, many listening will agree that it's fantastic that FSE have been carrying this out.
If I may add, football has been a bit late addressing the issue of LGBT inclusion and LGBT rights and the fight against all form of discrimination associated to it. We still see international tournaments in the UEFA region, but also elsewhere in the world, being handed over to countries that have a very poor background in terms of LGBT rights. So we also hope to raise awareness, and that in the future, both UEFA and FIFA uphold to their own anti-discrimination standards and question whether it is the right thing to do to hand over a competition to a country where LGBT fans, players, anyone working in football won't feel safe when they will be traveling.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's a really important point that you mentioned there. It does build into something much bigger and, you know, looking for the future outlook of football, doesn't it? Great. So moving on to the next question, Renan. So as activist groups, the pandemic has hit SD Europe and FSE in different ways. How would you describe the past 8 months for your organisation?
Well, I think the same as pretty much anyone else in the world. We had to adapt. Now we are in a relatively safe place because our funding hasn't been impacted. Then the biggest challenge for us was the postponing of the Euro 2020. It's been postponed 1 year, and we still don't know exactly how it's going to take place. And we have a project together with UEFA called Respect Fan Culture. So for my colleagues working on that project, we had to adapt. We had, for some of them, reduced the working hours and so on. And then, yeah, it became a whole different job. There's no more, we don't accompany or monitor the European away games anymore. And that was a big part of our work during the season. But we work differently. We do other things. We've been together with SD Europe monitoring the and communicating or sharing the solidarity actions done by fan groups especially during the first wave, during the first lockdown. And yeah, again, we can't complain. None of us, we haven't lost our job. Our organization still exists. So that's, compared to other people in Europe, we're in a good place. And yeah, we question the way we work. I'm sure we've been reinventing the way we work. We have a lot more Zoom calls, a lot less travels. And I think this will have a lasting impact on the way we do our job. And it's also a good occasion to try new project, to reach out to new people and to reinvent the way we work and we see football.
Mm-hmm. So as you say there, you know, you have to sort of reinvent the way that you work. What has the shift in priorities been for you this year? And what would you say has been top of your list? You know, is it the return to play, perhaps?
Yeah, certainly. Again, the monitoring European games was the core of our work during the season, and we don't have this. We're not doing this anymore. So return to play, yes, it's, we've been training ourselves through virus experts, whether it is the WHO or other partners in the world of, let's say, sports and human rights. We've learned from partners, from trade unions and other experts as well on how we can respond and how we can get ready for the return to play. Our let's say, biggest experience at the moment has been the Super Cup in Budapest, between the game between Bayern Munich and FC Sevilla, and which was like the real life experience, so to say. And we published a report on that basis with some recommendations. Now, a return to play with 25-30% in attendance seems entirely possible. But what we need to keep in mind also is that there shouldn't be any sort of pressure for fans to return, because this is, in the end, and I heard a few weeks ago, someone from the SGSA said it was all about a personal risk assessment. And that's what it is. We all, based on how we feel about the risk, how we feel physically, that's a personal decision whether we want to go back to the stadium or not, whether we think we can respect the social distancing rules. And as we see in France, but I'm sure it will be the case in many other European countries, some fan groups don't feel like returning to the stadium yet because they can't commit to respecting social distancing because that's the way we are used to interact with the game and to enjoy the game and so on. It's not possible at the moment, so some will simply decide not to go back. So I think our role as fan organization is to help match organizers to implement realistic return to stadium protocol that match the way we experience the game and what we think is possible and what we think is not. And then in the end, it's an individual choice whether people feel safe and ready to go back to the stadium.
Yeah, I think, you know, you make a good point there. You know, many, many groups across Europe will be looking at, you know, how fans are slowly returning to stadiums now. And it's still, you know, it's great to be able to go back and watch football, but it's still worlds away from what they're used to and what they enjoy. So it's a really important area of work, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's the same as what we do usually. We're just moving our usual methodology. You know, we both of our organizations believe in dialogue and that if you want to implement anything that has to do with fans, you need to ask them how they feel about it. If they agree, if they feel it's realistic, if they feel that they can do it. And unfortunately, in a certain number of countries, this is still not the case, despite of the recommendations from the European institution, despite of the recommendation by the WHO. We see. Even in the majority of European countries, return to stadia protocols being discussed and put in place without asking for the input of the very people that would be in charge of the actual implementation. And this is not a realistic scenario. You can't do it without the fans, because if you don't get them on board, then who is going to implement your protocols? And I'm afraid that in a certain number of European countries, the only response that would be offered would be a repressive one, which is stewards, police, whoever will be there, forcing people to respect the protocol. And that's not realistic. People need to buy it, need to feel, to own it. And that's how you can then have a crowd of 10,000-20,000 people implementing your protocols.
And, you know, I think this sort of quite neatly leads into the next question. You know, never has the truth of the saying football without fans is nothing be more apparent. You know, I think we've seen in Champions League games, you know, after matches, players pointing this out. How can we ensure that fans are fully part of the discussion surrounding the future of football when the pandemic is over?
I think it's true that football without fans is nothing. It's never been more apparent. And before the return of the game, we heard pundits, commentators saying that, yeah, it's not such a big deal that fans are not there. But in the end, TV ratings and comments from players and from anyone that actually watched the game shows that, yes, this is not the same show spectacle than it is usually. And all the attempts to replace fans by, you know, cartoon figures, augmented reality, or whatever, nothing is working. I think probably the most pathetic attempt is in Spain, where you see those, you know, it looks like the EA Sport game FIFA 1996. It doesn't even look good, and it is definitely not improving the experience of the fans. On the other hand, there's a real risk for a lost generation, because less and less people are watching TV. Obviously, because of the economic situation, a lot of fans don't have the money to pay for pay-per-view in England, or even just a regular TV subscription like here in France. And we see that the TV ratings are really, really, really low. So there is a risk for lost generation. There's a risk to lose a lot of the active fans that would potentially lose the connection to the game. And there was always a financial ceiling of how much money people can put into football because of the away travels, the season tickets, the TV subscriptions, and so on. And obviously, the ceiling is going lower and lower. And football need to stop believing in this fantasy of a forever growth. There's a limit. And if football wants to limit the impact of the pandemic on its economy, they need to bring the fans back on board, and they need to work closer with them. We've asked fans, clubs, leagues, FAs have asked fans for sacrifices. Some have given away, you know, the what was remaining of their season ticket to help clubs bridging the gap at the time when the game were stopped. And there needs to be a counterpart for this sacrifice. And so far, we haven't seen it. So we've heard this narrative that we're all on the same boat and we're all working together to save football. And today, there's an article from the New York Times showing that FIFA executive committee members haven't even slightly reduced their salary, the compensation they receive. So we're not all in the same boat. Fans have made sacrifices. Their personal life has been impacted. And giving away 100, 200, 300 euros on a season ticket, that's a lot of money for a lot of fans. So there needs to be an acknowledgement of the role we play in this pandemic. And there needs to be an acknowledgement that football can't continue to antagonize its most faithful supporters, to antagonize the communities. And the fairest thing to do now is to include fans' representative in discussion on the future of football and how football avoids to be put in the same financial situation in 5 years' time. And I think a lot of fans have realized now how fucked up football economy is, and how much big clubs are, for most of them, are pretty badly run companies, small companies, unsustainable with no reserves whatsoever. And I think this will have a lasting impact as well on let's say on the regular fan base, not the activists, but the people that are just going to games and following football from a safe distance, so to say. Then they will realize that even if your club is buying and selling players for millions, in the end there's nothing left at the end of the season, and that when you realize that, you realize how precarious the situation of your club is. So yeah, we can only hope for now and position ourselves to be ready to contribute to this conversation. But that would be the fair choice from the football governing bodies to do things differently in the future.
I think you mentioned some really poignant points there, you know, around this generation that could miss out. I think, you know, there's got to be some real work there. And I think that football can't be naive about that. There is genuinely some work that needs to be done to nurture, you know, the active fan culture, because that there is a danger of this sort of stopgap could have a damaging effect on that. And I think as well, you know, there's been the instance with FIFA that you mentioned about payments. I think in Spain as well, I believe, was it one of the executives at La Liga, you know, there's been a lot of discontent from Spanish supporters there. And again, you know, as you mentioned around, you know, clubs being able to spend millions on players and then at the end of the season somehow having nothing left. It's actually a culture that, you know, it's grown throughout football from the top to the bottom. And, you know, a lot of this really needs addressing.
I think a lot of us have reconsidered our priorities. Now, in France, we're in a much better situation than in England, for example, because our club can't really disappear. Worst case scenario, you lose the professional status and you start again 5-4-6 in the FIFA 6th division. It would be a terrible scenario for people working for your club. But in the end, it's not going to go away. It's not going to get bankrupt, disappear, or whatever. So when I said there's a shift in priorities, then once people realize that they can live without professional football, then the question of the values and what the club stand for and what you actually want from it and what you expect from it and what it brings to the communities, it changed completely the discussion, the narrative. And I think the expectations will be different in the future. And I speak for myself and my club, I think I would be happier with the club run differently and not playing in elite football than continuing with this nonsense and sustainable the management that it has at the moment. So yeah, definitely it's changing priorities.
So how do you see the next 3 years or so going in terms of supporter issues? Obviously you've mentioned a lot of things there, but is there anything specific that you see being a real challenge?
I think, and as I mentioned, we work with national team fans and there's a lot of uncertainty on where things are going. In terms of the Euro 2020 and 2021, the Men's World Cup in Qatar, the Women's World Cup in Australia and New Zealand. And I think for national team fans, it's a difficult moment, especially as it's a different community than club fans. You know, it's people that usually only come together at the time of the game. Well, the people who support the same club as you live in the same city, there are other forms of socialization. So I think it's a difficult time for national team fans, and I think there's a lot of concern of when things can return to normal and they can reconnect with the community that exists around the national team. For the rest of us and for club fans, the biggest question at the moment, what will have the biggest influence on the future of the game, or at least the way we live it, is the upcoming reform of the UEFA competition, which could have, depending on which way things go, could have an influence on everyone from elite football to non-league, because we could have all different calendars and a completely different seasons and so on. The difficulty at the moment, and it's been the same thing for a year and a half, is that we can only work with rumors and whatever a few clubs are willing to drop to the media. So there hasn't been a transparent process, and there hasn't been a process with a clear involvement of fans. So obviously that's what we expect. Things are definitely going to speed up in the coming weeks and at the beginning of 2021. So obviously that's something we are going to watch very closely. And then the return to normal in the next year, in the next season, two seasons, three seasons, once the rest of the society returns to normal, I think priority topic for fan organization will be that we're not treated differently. So at the time of the first wave, the first lockdown, and even now, the vast majority of fan groups have accepted the situation, have had a mature approach to the lockdown, have played an active role in the solidarity and so on, because the rest of the society was at the same place. But the rights that we are putting on hold at the moment, the rights of movement, the rights, the freedom of movement, the right to go to a football game and so on, it's just on pause. And whenever the rest of the society is back on track, is back to normal, we can only expect that we're treated the same way. Yeah. And that the pandemic is not used as an excuse to reduce our rights. So in a certain number of European countries, there are discussions at the moment on whether the limitation of freedom of movement, freedom of assembly, even freedom of expression that has been imposed due to the pandemic, and that is fairly legitimate in most cases, whether there are limitations to it and when we return to normal. So I think we have to watch this space, because some countries with a track record of not really treating football fans as humans, there will be a strong temptation to actually use the pandemic to reduce again our rights. So again, it's only assumptions, hypothesis, but this is a space that we're going to watch closely in the coming months and years, I suppose.
Well, Renan, that was fantastic. That's about all we have time for today. So to finish this off, is there anything that you would like to say to the people and the supporters listening, you know, just about FSC's work going forwards, or, you know, whatever you would like, really?
No, I think we've discussed only really worrying topics, but also positive things going on. The pandemic has reinforced the solidarity between fans and fan groups. I've reinforced the communities, and I think we need to give credit to those communities, to those fans for that, and that the experience that a lot of fan groups have had during the pandemic will also have a legacy, and I think we are going to play a more important roles in our respective communities in the future.
Well, that was great. Thanks ever so much, Renan. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Likewise. Thanks, Luke.
Thanks so much for listening to this podcast. Please do listen to the other podcasts in this mini-series in addition to the ones that we've previously published. To find out more information about SD Europe, head to www.sdeurope.eu.